the El Paso Court of Appeals has not only let respondents escape summary judgment on their admitted debt, but they've provided a roadmap for all other defaulting borrowers who seek to avoid or delay action on their accounts.
If we were to decide that this case were governed by Section 9504, is there a question remaining about the commercial reasonableness of the sale?
No, Your Honor, there is not. The evidence is clear from the record with respect to the actions of the foreclosure sale.
Well, are you asking us to find that based on the evidence submitted in the record as a matter of law? Or is there a procedural hurdle?
I don't think there is a procedural hurdle at all. The Court of Appeals did not address and did not overturn the trial court's finding with respect to foreclosure, and the trial court found, as a matter of law, that the foreclosure had been handled, that the actions taken by Riyadh Bank were appropriate. Thus, I think this court can write an opinion that corrects the errors of law that basically melded the two statutes together. What respondents have been doing is saying that the foreclosure was an attempt to take possession of the collateral in order to collect, and thereby pushing it under 9502.
Before you go further into discussing the two provisions, I need to follow up on Justice O'Neill's question to make sure that I'm clear, too. The bank moved for summary judgment in this case under Section 9.504?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Was there any controverting summary judgment evidence that went to whether the sale was commercially reasonable?
Not that raised a material issue of fact.
So it's your position then that the bank did establish as a matter of law that it was entitled to summary judgment, that the sale had been held in accordance with the terms of Section 9.504, and that was not controverted, and therefore rendering judgment for the bank is proper on that basis?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
With respect to the actions of the bank, with respect to the foreclosure sale, the security agreement, besides Section 9.504, governed. And the security agreement provided certain things that Riyadh would do. And in fact, Riyadh Bank went beyond their requirements, what they had contractually promised to do, and they did more in order to ensure to have the best opportunity to have bidders and to get the maximum value at the foreclosure sale. They conducted the foreclosure sale. They gave more notice. They only were required to give 10 days notice. They gave 15 days notice. They conducted the sale. They actually did generate interest. Folks came and they wanted to see and inquired about the receivables. But, in fact, after inquiring about the receivables, determined that they had no interest to bid.
What level of specificity does your proof have on that point? I haven't looked at it. You name names of who came and inquired?
No, Your Honor. The affidavit.
It's just the affidavit.
It's an affidavit. It's a summary judgment without almost very little discovery. It was a summary judgment case. And so we do not have a complete record as if this had gone all the way through trial. But again, that is another point of why this case is of such importance. Because when you have a simple promissory note case, which is what this case was, the appropriate vehicle to, in order for financial institutions to have finality and to be able to move forward and try to collect on default from defaulting borrowers, is to have the vehicle of a summary judgment. We not only had the summary judgment hearing, then there was a rehearing on the summary judgment.
Well, and I don't mean to keep hammering this point, but I am confused about it. If you move for summary judgment, again, let's assume that 9504 is the applicable statute. You put in summary judgment proof that the sale was commercially reasonable. Is it my understanding they put on no controverting proof as to the commercial reasonableness?
They put in an affidavit from which...
We've got that affidavit.
You've got the entire record.
But is our burden then to, if we decide that 504 applies, to review your summary judgment proof to determine if you shifted the burden in the first instance, or has that been not preserved for appeal?
I don't. Although it was raised on appeal because respondents raised every ground, the Court of Appeals did not address. Before the Court of Appeals was the issue of, was the foreclosure sale commercially reasonable? And the Court of Appeals didn't address it. And one can only assume, because when they looked at the record from below, they found there was no genuine issue of material fact, because the the trial court, in looking at this, one could say, was the amount bid for these accounts receivable, was it sufficient? But the record is replete that these are valueless accounts. And the fact that somebody merely says, I think the price was too low, does not automatically mean summary judgment is not.
And I suppose part of my confusion is understand that after the summary judgment was granted in your favor, a counterclaim was filed attacking the commercial reasonableness, and that counterclaim was struck. And that's where my confusion is as to whether it was properly controverted in the first instance in the motion for summary judgment, or if it was brought up untimely after the motion for summary judgment was filed or granted.
Additional claims, after the summary judgment was granted, additional allegations were made, which the trial court found to be unreasonable. The primary allegation there, which then formed the basis of where the appellate court went, was this issue of this credit report by Riyad Bank to the Saudi Arabian Monetary Agency, which has been referred to as blacklisting in order to give it this cloud, this imprimatur of something bad and evil that happened. And it was that issue that was raised and said that tainted the activity. But in fact, if you look at the briefing by respondents, you first had a foreclosure sale, then this alleged blacklisting, which if the foreclosure sale happened and they were then Riyadh's accounts, the fact that there was blacklisting would be a material after. But the Court of Appeals, without anybody having raised this issue, has now taken that allegation of blacklisting and has basically said that the foreclosure sale was Riyadh's attempt to take possession and control of the collateral, and they moved it then under 9502 and said now we have a question of fact of whether there was in fact an attempt to collect by this blacklisting.
The counterclaims were filed after the trial court granted summary judgment.
Yes.
And the summary judgment disposed of all claims and all parties?
Yeah, this case has had a kind of a tortured procedural.
I'm trying to get the counterclaims now in perspective in terms of procedurally. Were they filed then after a final summary judgment had been entered and while the trial court's primary power still existed?
Yes.
Is that what happened? Or were there still claims pending that had not been disposed of at the time the counterclaim was filed?
The counterclaim, it was during the plenary power of the trial court.
So we had a final summary judgment. The plenary power had not expired yet, and that's when the counterclaim alleging the blacklisting activities was filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And when then we had a second hearing before the trial court at which all of this was raised one more time along with the blacklisting, and we then moved to dismiss the counterclaim, the motion for rehearing on the summary judgment, and we filed a motion to dismiss these counterclaims as late filed, et cetera, and they were then dismissed. But the issues here of some import that have an effect across the board with financial institutions, which is why the Texas Bankers Association filed an amicus brief, is what has happened is almost any activity now of a financial institution under the Court of Appeals holding could be seen to be a collection activity. Because what we have here is this allegation of credit reporting. Saudi Arabia banks report to the Saudi Arabian Monetary Agency of this informal gathering and they discuss delinquent debtors. And so there's known who is delinquent and who is not delinquent.
Is that pursuant to a law in Saudi Arabia or is that merely the custom?
It is a custom. And perhaps a formalized custom that makes it is what is done. Whether there's some statutory basis, I'm not aware of it. But it is absolutely the way banks who practice and work in Saudi Arabia, that is their normal custom, is to get together, they discuss, and they report. And it is akin to banks here in the States that do credit report. They can report to a credit agency the delinquency of some borrower. But the fact of the reporting does not make it a collection. And in fact, the trial court certainly found it, and the affidavit of Galani certainly supports. The allegation was that this credit reporting, this blacklisting, was done to destroy the accounts, certainly not collect.
And there's no evidence at all to the extent that your client said, pay up or we're going to report you?
No.
The reporting was just done and discovered by the other side after the fact?
Yes.
So there was no attempt to get them to pay to forestall the reporting?
No. And in fact, the foreclosure had occurred prior to this activity. So what we have here is the basis of the Court of Appeals looking at the collection activity, and as a matter of law, what was done cannot be a collection. And under this court's holding in color, we fall squarely under it. There was no commercial agreement of Riyadh Bank at all. The district court properly recognized that truthful credit reporting is not an attempt to collect under 9502, and they properly recognize that the summary judgment establishes that Riyadh made no attempt to collect. The foreclosure activity of Riyadh Bank was appropriate. As I said, we've had 6 years. We've been to every court, bankruptcy court, district court, court of appeals, and now here. The dramatic effect that this has on Riyadh Bank, but on all financial institutions, is the whole value of a summary judgment on an admitted debt. There is no controversy that the $2 million is owed and hasn't been repaid. And so what we have is a situation on an admitted debt. The defendants, the borrowers, have been allowed to prolong and extract and not repay and hide behind now this Court of Appeals opinion.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please support Mr. Moscone to present argument in correspondence?
Your Honors, I'd like to begin with a point that I think Ms. Militello and I agree on, and it might help me clarify a couple of things. I agree that the collection of accounts by a secured party is governed by Section 9.502. I am not trying to mix and confuse 9504 and 9502. The problem with this case, and the reason why the analysis gets complicated, there are actually two reasons. Number one, the bank did something very unusual. The bank did not... Ordinarily, when a lender has a security interest or assignment of accounts, they merely collect the accounts. They don't typically foreclose. In this case, they did foreclose. And I believe there's also summary judgment evidence that they took action to collect the debt.
But they had the right to foreclose. You don't dispute that.
I do not dispute.
And if they had the right to foreclose and chose to foreclose on the security interest they held in the accounts receivable, then 9.504 governs that sale.
It governs with respect to the foreclosure sale.
So correct. 9.504 does apply to this case?
Absolutely, with respect to the foreclosure sale. I think, Your Honor, it's best to think of it as two tracks. To the extent that the bank conducted a foreclosure sale and got the benefits of that foreclosure sale, which are substantial, they take ownership and title to the property, they exclude my clients from any ability to thereafter collect, I mean, they take it over. They bid it in for $10, a $2 million account receivable, but they did bid in for $10. If they later go out and collect $2 million, they can pocket the whole $2 million and not credit my clients with a penny. So they're serious, serious.
Not necessarily. Aren't they subject to commercial reasonableness?
Yes.
Okay.
If that's why, when you,
so
I'm saying the legal effect.
So you have an out on that. So.
Absolutely. That's why the law balances the rights of the debtor, of my client in this
why
case.
Why should they credit your client with any money when they lent $2 million to start with and never got paid anything? I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor, in the summary
judgment... Unless they aren't paid and they defaulted, they're entitled to take the collateral and get as much as they can or as little as they can.
That's correct. They may foreclose so long as they do so in a commercially reasonable manner. The summary judgment evidence reflects here that the account debtor, Bondaria, the Saudi company, was willing to pay money, had made an offer to pay money, and the bank didn't take it. Now, my client, after the foreclosure sale, didn't have the right to go in and try and collect that money itself and apply it to the debt. We're cut off. We don't own the account anymore. We have no right to collect it. That's why the law imposes on the bank a duty, if they are going to cut my clients off, to do so in a commercially reasonable manner.
Was there controverting summary judgment proof as part of the record in this case? that the sale was not conducted in a commercially reasonable manner as required by Section 9.504?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what was that proof?
That proof, two things. First of all, we went through in the brief and in the summary judgment evidence. Now, there's summary judgment evidence on both sides, by the way, as to what happened, as to what actually the foreclosure, the notice and the sale consisted of. It consisted of putting a notice at the Harris County Courthouse. It consisted of blah, blah, blah.
And they proved all of that up as part of showing their entitlement.
That's
to
true.
Summary judgment to be able to collect on the note, but on the obligation. But my question is, what controverting proof did you offer on the question of commercial reasonableness of the sale?
There's an affidavit of Mr. Al-Ghulani, my client, an experienced Saudi businessman, explaining that if you're going to sell an account receivable, that is money owed by a Saudi company, a commercially reasonable way to do that must include some notice to the Saudi business community that would have an interest in purchasing it. In this case, the summary judgment evidence shows there was no posting at the Saudi consulate in Houston or anywhere. There was no advertising in any media that would be read by a Saudi businessman. The only thing they did are the things Your Honor mentioned a minute ago. And Mr. Al-Ghulani testified in his affidavit as a Saudi businessman that that would not be a commercially reasonable sale of the collateral.
And did the trial court, in granting the summary judgment motion, determine that the bank had met its burden of proof as a matter of law and yours was insufficient to controvert?
I'm not quite sure what the court
determined. Reason I ask that is I'm trying to decide what we're supposed to be doing here in evaluating that claim. I mean, do we look at the bank's proof in the first instance, determine whether it shifted the burden, and then whether Mr. Ghulani's affidavit controverted it? What exactly are we supposed to be doing?
Before I answer that question directly, the Court of Appeals did not reach the 9504 issue.
Right.
I'm not sure why, because I actually think it's a much stronger argument in my client's favor than the collection argument, which has some problems I was going to get to mention. But with respect to that issue, under the Great House decision, which is a Supreme Court decision, once the issue of commercial reasonableness is raised on a foreclosure sale, the lender has a duty to prove that the sale is commercially reasonable. In the context of summary judgment, as in this case, that would be a burden to show that the sale was commercially reasonable as a matter of law. And I do have in our brief an analysis of the cases that deal with the summary judgment analysis in this particular kind of case. And what they show is that there are only some very narrow circumstances in which summary judgment has been approved on commercial reasonableness once the issue is raised. And those issues, those circumstances have to do with situations in which one of the statutory, there are some statutory presumptions of reasonableness. If you can prove the basis for one of those and there's no opposition testimony, courts have approved summary judgment. And that's not the case here. And that's something we talk about in the brief. But as I said, that's not an issue, although it was not reached by the Court of Appeals, it can be reached by this court, obviously. And in my mind,
you say that it wasn't in the petitioner's brief on the merits. How do we reach the 9.504 issue?
Because it's an alternative ground for affirmance of the judgment of the Court of Appeals. And my understanding is that I think this court has two options. I think we're to reverse on the 9.502 analysis, and that would be to affirm on the basis that summary judgment should have been denied under my 9.504 defense. Either one is sufficient to have denied
summary judgment. Shouldn't we remand that to the Court of Appeals?
I think you have the discretion to do either. I think it would be up to Your Honor. I'm just saying I think the court has the option to either reach the issue or send it to the Court of Appeals. On the 9.502 issue, the 9.504 issue, by the way, I think is absolutely crystal clear. There is summary judgment evidence. There is no case on the kind of evidence we have in the record here where a summary judgment has been approved under 9.504. There is none, and there shouldn't be one. Now, 9.502 is where the El Paso Court of Appeals went out on a limb. And I wanted to stand up here and kind of make a confession, which is that we all know what practicing law is like. If hindsight were foresight and I could put myself 3 years in the past when I drafted this affidavit, I would have made it a little clearer. However, the cases are clear that in evaluating summary judgment, which is what we're doing here, that every reasonable inference is to be given to the non-movement, in this case my clients. And that's why I think you go back to Mr. Al-Ghulani's affidavit. And I'd like to point out two or three things briefly that are in that affidavit that I think give rise to a reasonable assumption that what the bank did is collect the account.
Before you get to that, can we talk about the law for just a minute?
Sure.
I'm a little bit confused about how 9.502 dovetails with 9.504 when we know we started this whole procedure with a sale under 9.504.
Well, I'm not
why
sure.
Why is that in the inquiry at that point in time? How do those two provisions work together? Because I think I understand that's what you're saying happens here.
Yes, Your Honor. I think I'd go back to the first assumption in your question, which is that the foreclosure sale occurred first. Summary judgment record is actually a little unclear on which happened first. I know Ms. Militello said they foreclosed first, but I think the collection activities, as suggested in the affidavit, were ongoing. I happen to think that if the summary judgment evidence showed that, let's say, they foreclosed on day one, and they do so in a commercially reasonable manner, it's a valid foreclosure sale, not subject to attack, my client from that point forward has no interest whatsoever in the collection of the account. They can't.
Right, so 9.502 then is gone.
I will agree with that.
All right.
If they conducted, now this case is complicated by two reasons. Number one, I don't believe they conducted a commercially reasonable foreclosure sale. But number two, it's not clear in the record when they conducted that sale. I take it back. There's a date on the affidavit as to the date it was conducted. The collection activities seem to be ongoing, and the inference is that they occur both before and after the sale.
Right, which occurred first, the collection, the foreclosure or the report to SAMA?
I think, the summary judgment record is not 100% clear on that. I think reading the affidavit in a light most favorable to the non-respondent, it was a continuing activity. These are things that were going on.
Is there not a date certain when the first report to SAMA occurred?
It is not in the record because we haven't had discovery on that point. I would love to take a deposition and find out exactly when it occurred. What we did learn is that Bonderia's banking privileges were cut off and it was put out of business. We don't know exactly what date the reporting occurred. But I do agree that if the evidence went back to the trial court and was fully developed, and if all the collection activity were to occur after a valid foreclosure sale, there's another nit here in this case because I don't think the foreclosure sale was commercially reasonable. But if you had a commercially reasonable foreclosure sale, it doesn't matter what they did. 9502, there is no collection of the debtor's account because it's not the debtor's account anymore. The bank has purchased the account.
So what facts in this case are in the summary judgment record that allow you to argue that 9.52 is in play here, since I take it you take the position that the foreclosure sale did not come first in a commercially reasonable manner and foreclosing rights under 9.52?
Yes. Although I think the issue is not crystal clear, Mr. Alcalani's affidavit first of all makes clear that there were negotiations between the bank and the account debtor, Bonderia. And if you're not going to collect the account, if the bank's going to make a decision that hands off, we don't want this account, which they have a right to do, we just want to sue on the $2 million note, why are they undertaking negotiations? There's actually an offer here, and the offer was to pay the balance of the note over time, a down payment, and start making monthly payments. And the bank turned down that offer and instead blacklisted Bonderia. Now, I think that the court, first of all, should make the related point.
But if they turned down the offer, then how do they undertake to collect?
I think
it sounds like affirmative steps. I want the money now. Pay me. And instead they said, no, thank you.
What they did is say, we don't want that offer. Instead, we're blacklisting you. It was in the context of when it occurred, I think the reasonable inference is that it was a collection activity. I wish it were clear, but I think you have to read it.
As a common sense matter, why would they want to damage the one asset or piece of collateral? If they knew that this blacklisting was going to destroy the account, what would be the motivation to do
to be honest, I would hope that this court can take judicial notice that we're talking about law and practices in Saudi Arabia, and I think Ms. Militello even suggested when she was speaking that the practice is different there, and the banks meet. And they are not, unfortunately we haven't had a trial yet, but my understanding of the procedures in Saudi Arabia when you have an account is you don't go down and file a lawsuit. They don't have lawsuits like we have. They are geared more towards punishment. They still have debtor's prison for individuals who don't pay debts in Saudi Arabia. It's a different society and a different set of laws. And I think that the blacklisting is how they collect. That is, you don't pay, we'll destroy you. They don't think, the legal system there does not think like ours does. And I think you have to understand it in that context.
We don't have a whole lot of law under Section 9.502. And Cullen, I think is a case in which there was an undertaking to collect the accounts receivable. And there was a whole lot of activity on the part of the bank in that instance to be able to collect on the accounts receivable. How would you define undertake to collect, and at what point in time or at what level of activity does a bank cross over the line into the undertaking to collect area?
Well, you're right, there's not much case law.
This is not a Cullen case in terms of that level of activity.
Well, in fact, Cullen did not involve the collection of an account. I reread it again this morning. Cullen involved the question of notice. That is when.
Right, but the underlying facts involve them going into the company and monitoring, and when accounts receivable came in, they were turned over to the bank and all of those kinds of things. So there was a level of activity there that there was an undertaking to collect. Where are we going to draw that line?
I think there has to be some assertion of a right to collect, and it arises in a default situation. In other words, the mere notice to an account debtor that, by the way, any payments you make, you should send to us, 9502 treats as a separate issue. That was, in fact, the notice issue that was in effect in Cullen. So merely sending a letter saying, when you make your next payment, send it to me, is not a collection. That's notice to make payment to the S&E. I think that there has to be a situation where there's a default and the lender takes some affirmative step to collect, and in this country that affirmative step may be a different sort than it would be in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, where you don't have the same kind of civil process to collect a debt, that may be taken by blacklisting.
Well, how would you define undertake to collect? What kind of activity would we need to see from a bank for a bank to be undertaking to collect an account?
I think that I'm not sure you can have a rule for all cases. It has to be an affirmative action, and the Fifth Circuit has said in a case cited in the briefs that it is a taking control of the account. I don't agree that it's an exclusive taking control. That's a foreclosure sale. When the bank forecloses, the debtor, the borrower, then can't do anything. The law doesn't say you have to foreclose as lender to collect. So clearly it contemplates that something can be done short of taking exclusive control. And that may be sending a demand letter, filing a lawsuit, or in this case, under the law and practice of a foreign country where the practice is blacklisting, I think blacklisting. And all I'm really saying is I think that deserves some factual development in the trial.
If we rule in your favor, would it not put banks in jeopardy? When in the United States they report somebody to a credit agency?
Okay. I answer that with a firm no, and I couldn't be more firm about it, Your Honor. If you look at the affidavit, I know that the bank keeps saying this is garden variety credit reporting. That's not what it is. And I think the affidavit makes that clear.
Even assuming that it's more severe, that it puts a kind of pinch upon the debtor than it does in the United States when a report is made to a credit agency, what we would be required to do is at some time in the future try to draw a line between reporting to a credit agency and something such as reporting to SAMA.
I think so, and I think the line is where you start to take a unified action against that debtor. If we had in this country some kind of body that could decree merely you go to a meeting and you say this debtor is in default, therefore they have no banking services, state or federal, they can't have a bank account. They're out of business, I'd have a hard time saying, well, that's just credit reporting, as opposed to merely submitting the name to some credit agency and different banks and creditors can do with it as they will.
Mr. Cohn, I take it you then really do disagree with how Judge Reveley defines 9.502 undertaking to collect in the Fifth Circuit case you were mentioning a minute ago.
I think it may be.
If you're talking about credit reporting, that's a whole long way from how he defines it as. The requirement thus comes into play when the secured party takes possession and control of the accounts, preventing the debtor from acting on the accounts himself, or when the secured party undertakes collection so as to entitle the debtor to rely on the former to protect the accounts. We're a long way from that in this case.
I think that's.
Aren't we?
Yes. And
it's
I'm
a very
not,
long way.
I think that is too strong. And the reason why I think that is too strong is because it basically defines a foreclosure sale. So if you accept that definition of collection,
I don't know that it does, because it's allowing the debtor to rely on the former to protect the accounts. I mean, it doesn't imply a taking over of ownership. It takes over control in terms of getting them collected, much like in the Cullen case. But it doesn't cross over the line so that ownership is actually transferred.
Mm-hmm.
So where are we going to draw? I mean, if where are we going to draw the line?
I don't think you have to draw the absolute line in this case. Unfortunately, the factual record could bear a lot more development in this case, and I think that to get back to the point that this is in Saudi Arabia, the line may be very different when you're talking about collection activities under normal practices of what American lawyers and American banks do and what they do in Saudi Arabia. And the fact is that they don't have the same type of civil system that we do. They don't just send a demand letter and file a lawsuit. This is what they do to collect. This is my understanding, in Saudi Arabia.
If this is what they do to collect, how could they collect anything after something like this happens? In other words, going back to what Justice O'Neill raised earlier, this is damaging the debtor so badly that there is no meaningful hope of collection later on.
I'm not saying we should adopt the system here, but why do they have debtor's prison? How would you collect something if you put someone...
Because is it not a key that it must be an attempt to collect?
It's for 9502 to apply.
Right. Yes. And if all that is happening is punishment as opposed to an attempt to collect, then it seems like the attempt to collect issue is not triggered.
I think that's how they, you know, maybe an odd way of thinking about it, but I think in Saudi Arabia that's what they do to collect.
Okay, hold on, because I mean, you still haven't demonstrated how reporting to SAMA is an attempt to collect. You've made clear your opinion that reporting to SAMA is an attempt to punish, but there is no, I haven't heard a single word on your part yet that reporting to SAMA is an attempt by the bank to get money,
okay,
to repay the debt.
It was my assumption, and I wish this were more clearly spelled out in the affidavit, but it was my assumption that if the account debtor then went to SAMA and said, okay, here's cash, the whole thing, that they would lift the blacklist.
Is there any evidence of that in the record?
That is not in the record. And that's why I started out saying that, unfortunately, you know, if hindsight were foresight, the summary judgment evidence on my part on that point could have been a little better. But in evaluating a summary judgment, the court is to indulge every reasonable inference in behalf of the non-movement. And I think when you read this affidavit as a whole, that the 9502 issue is still alive, even though, as I said before, I still think the 9504 issue is a much stronger one, which is unfortunately not reached by the Court of Appeal.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May I please support? We Are Bank operates in Texas. We are not talking about actions in Saudi Arabia except for this credit reporting that occurred over there, because Riyadh also operates in Saudi Arabia. But we can't lose sight of the fact Riyadh operates in Texas. The loan at issue was made in Houston. The security agreements spelled out what the bank would do in the event of a default. The bank not only did all of that, but went beyond the contractual requirements. We can't read in more and say, well, if you only had posted it somewhere else, if you had gone to the Saudi consulate, maybe if you had called up some guy in Saudi Arabia, you might have found somebody interested. Every single foreclosure sale could always be attacked by somebody saying, I have another idea of how you could conduct this sale. There has got
Suppose, though, the debtor comes forward and says, we are in a unique business enterprise. They are foreclosing on the product of this unique business enterprise, and they simply posted at the courthouse door they were going to sell it and only got $10 for it, if they had simply advertised with the unique business enterprises who use this unique product, they would have generated a positive cash sale rather than negative. Isn't that some evidence that it's not commercially reasonable?
Not in this case, because the debtors in this case, particularly Galini and Adele, are officers and directors of Banderia. It is Galini's other company. Notice was given to Galini, appropriate notice, more notice than was required, was given to Galini of this foreclosure sale.
So it's a factual specific reason why this isn't commercially unreasonable as opposed to generally speaking.
I also think that when you have accounts receivable, as the comments to the code section state, you know, there's a unique type of collateral that the debtor has the opportunity to go out and to collect. In this case, if they were not so apparently worthless, if the debtor thought there was value to this collateral, he could have, before the posting for foreclosure, collected the debt. Certainly could have tried Banderia if they thought they could have appeared at the foreclosure sale. The bankruptcy trustee walked away from these accounts to have a material issue.
Well, and that's the argument for any asset that gets foreclosed on. If the asset really had the value that the debtor says they have, they could have gone out and found money to pay for that asset. I mean, isn't that
general
argument?
In this particular instance, no, I don't think so, because we have accounts receivable. As the court notes, or as the code section notes, they are unique because there isn't a question of valuation. If Banderia owes $2.9 million, and that's the value, and they had the money and were able to pay, they could have just paid it over. We're not talking about tangible property where there might be a question as to the value. They could have then collected, gone, the debtor could have collected, Banderia could have come in and bid. certainly the bankruptcy trustee had a fiduciary duty to try and maximize for the creditors the value,
but
and
again,
he walks away from
it. It seems as though you're arguing facts that you want us to add up and decide as a matter of law.
No, Your Honor, but I do think that before an issue, before you can overturn a summary judgment, there has to be a genuine issue of material fact.
Well, I thought your 9.504, the 9.504 claim was dismissed by the trial court. It's not timely filed.
It is. It was raised. Now, it was decided by the trial court, and then they added counterclaims and tried a second attack, and both of them were dismissed. But 950, it was a 9504 argument originally, as well as a 9502 argument. All of it was briefed. Trial court granted summary judgment. The value of the accounts came up at the first instance. Then they raised this destruction of the collateral, and as this court has noted, it makes no sense to destroy collateral if you are attempting to collect it. And I would call the court's attention to page 6 of respondent's brief on the merits, page 6 and 7. Here it clearly says that first, the bank took an unusual step for a lender that does not want to collect the accounts. The bank foreclosed. Then they say, secondly, we are then placed the primary account that are on a blacklist. So the respondent's brief clearly says foreclosure, then blacklisting. What we have here is a situation where there's a request for the court to indulge every inference, and by that allow them to keep coming forward, change the facts, allege new things. There will never be a summary judgment available to a financial institution if that is allowed.
But I'm confused again on the summary judgment standard of commercial reasonableness, and I hate to keep hammering this, but the affidavit of Paul Travis, which I presume was offered by the bank to establish as a matter of law commercial reasonableness, there is no real statement about, I mean, it says what was done in a very limited manner in terms of disposing of the collateral. Galani's affidavit, on the other hand, purports to qualify him as an expert in business affairs and commercial transactions and says, based on the foregoing, I conclude that the sale was not commercially reasonable. Does the bank need someone to make a sort of expert type of conclusion that it was a commercially reasonable sale, that you're familiar with sales of this type of collateral? I mean, isn't that an expert, perhaps, determination, or doesn't there need to be some sort of statement to that effect?
No, Your Honor, I do not think that there needs to be to have an expert then come back and make that kind of determination. I always have to have the factual development for this reason. The bank has a duty to show that it did foreclose the commercial reasonable manner, and that's what Mr. Travis's affidavit does. It sets out all the things that the bank did, which was not only what the agreements required, but even beyond what the agreements required. The fact that Mr. Galani comes back in and says, well, I don't think that it's commercially reasonable because I don't think that it was good enough notice, and I don't think the value was enough, is basically what he says. Forgetting the hearsay problem, the affidavit or one of just an interested party, the court looks at that and says, all right, if there's a material issue, any issue of material fact, I can't grant summary judgment. It looks at those two issues, and the trial court determined that with respect to notice, the bank gave more notice, posted, and did what was required under the security agreement. And there is nothing in any law that says then we have to go back and do even more. And we did what was commercially reasonable for a loan in Houston, Texas. We're talking about they borrowed money in Houston, Texas. One of the debtors still lives in the United States. So to say
that this is... Can you point me to the part of the security agreement that controls the foreclosure?
Just a moment. But while we're pulling that, I can quickly answer the last part of it. With respect to the value of the collateral, again, I think what the trial court did is look at this and say, all right, there has been an issue raised of whether the value was great enough. And then the court did an analysis and says, has a genuine issue of material fact been raised? And what the court then looked at and said, what is the evidence about value? Here we have Banderia, the account debtor being affiliated company of the debtor, with officers and directors being debtor of Banderia. They didn't come to the foreclosure sale. They didn't bid at the foreclosure sale. The bankruptcy trustee walked away from these assets. There's no paper to support these accounts receivable. They disappeared in a mysterious fire.
Well, again,
$10 was too much.
I'm trying to find it. When you say you complied with the security agreement, are you talking about Section 602A?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where does it say anything about how the sale will be conducted?
With respect, about two-thirds of the way down, the requirement of sending reasonable notice shall be met if such notice is mail, postage, prepaid to debtor at the address designated at the beginning of
the sale. That's notice to the debtor of the sale. Where does it define what would be a commercially reasonable sale?
I think that under the security agreement, the parties contracted to, this would be the rights in the event of a default, what the bank was required to do.
Well, I understood you to say that under the security agreement, the bank complied with its posting and foreclosure notice requirements, but that's not what this says. This only deals with notice to the debtor of the foreclosure sale.
Yes.
So still, it's governed by general commercial reasonableness. The parties didn't agree as to what would be commercially reasonable.
No.
Okay.
No more than what is in this agreement. I do think that the agreement, that they went beyond the notice, and again, by giving the debtor more notice. If the debtor had come to Riyadh Bank and said, fine, you are posting in the Houston Chronicle, this is a Texas law, the Houston law, you're posting in the Houston Chronicle, you posted at the courthouse, but we think that there is XYZ person in Saudi Arabia that might be interested in this. You give notice there. They remained silent. They didn't come to the bank. They didn't come to the foreclosure sale. So what we would be doing is adding a level to a bank to say in every situation, the bank then posts by what is considered commercially reasonable, and for a bank in Houston, the bank undertook what is commercially reasonable, but now it has to sit back and say, after we conduct this foreclosure sale, I wonder what it is the debtor wants to come back later and challenge us on. You could never have finality. There will never be able to be. It would be on a step-by-step basis. We'd back like in the very first case this court heard this morning. There would never be able to be a standard. You'd have to look at each debtor and the particular significance, and do they have maybe contact somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in the States that would have to also be noticed? And that would become, again, banking law particularly different.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.